The first homicide of 2016 in Fresno was of a Punjabi man at a liquor store. A week earlier, an elderly sick man was deliberately hit by a truck and then beat up by two men. Police consider the attack a hate crime and are offering a $5,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of the two men suspected. To discuss why the sudden uptick in violence against the Sikh community and the reasons why criminals are confusing Sikhs and Muslims in these hate acts, we are joined by two guests. In our studio, we have Deep Singh. He is one of the founders of the Jakara Movement, a Sikh youth organization working on issues of social, health, and educational justice. Deep volunteers with the Fresno-based branch of Jakara. Deep, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also joining us on the phone, we have Arjun Singh Sethi, the director of the law and of law and policy for the Sikh Coalition. He is responsible for advocating and promoting policy solutions to civil rights issues that impact Sikhs and the broader American public. He's a regular contributor to Al Jazeera America, CNN, The Washington Post, and USA Today, and an adjunct professor at Georgetown University's Law Center. Arjun, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Deep, I want to start with you. Certainly has to be a difficult start to 2016. What's the mood in your community like right now following the most recent attack?
I think there's a little bit of conversation and a bit of apprehension. I wouldn't say that there's any fear. I think for the most part, people live their lives. It is a point of discussion. It's a point of even contention within the community in terms of creating internal dialogue here in Fresno. But I think the overall mood is frustration and apprehension, but not necessarily fear or anything of the sort.
Making this situation even more troubling, this is not the first time this has happened, and this is not the first time it's happened in Fresno. Going back to 2013, there was a case of an elderly Sikh man who also was beaten, also in an anonymous attack, very similar, in fact, to the one that just happened a few weeks ago. How concerned is the community that these things are continue to happen, and there's a lack of some change here?
I think there's definitely some concern. It's difficult to say exactly to have a complete idea of the trajectory and sort of how long these things have happened. Really since 9/11, because of groups like your fellow guest Arjun and the Sikh Coalition, the Sikh community has become much more better at tracking it. So those that happened before, they just, to be honest, weren't really tracked. So it's always also hard to see if whether something's an uptick or not for that very reason. The reality is, and I think many immigrants have gone through the same experiences where violence against them and periodic violence, and sometimes more. There are periods where it becomes more, certain periods it becomes less, but has been a reality for a lot longer time.
Want to bring in Arjun now. Put this in context for us beyond just these local stories that we're talking about today. Is this something that you're seeing throughout America at this time, or is this isolated here in Fresno?
Community members have reported a major uptick in bias and bullying and hate violence. So I would actually say that many Sikh Americans are afraid, and I think deservedly so. It's a very, very politically sensitive time. I think political rhetoric has legitimized racism and bigotry. And yes, what we're seeing in Fresno and in California is not isolated. The Sikh Coalition has received numerous reports from across the country of Sikh Americans being targeted in one way or another.
So what is the community trying to do to stop this and turn this around?
Well, there's a lot of things, right? The one thing is ensuring that the federal government investigate and prosecute hate crimes whenever and wherever they occur, ensuring that states do exactly the same thing. Also, asking the broader American public not to be a bystander, right? So I would ask every American, if they see bigotry, if they see hate violence, to condemn it in whatever way you can. So, for example, we know that a Gurdwara was vandalized in California, in Buena Park Gurdwara in Orange County. I think it would be very welcome for Americans in that community to write the congregation a letter, you know, expressing their concern, to opine on social media. So really, I think there's a role that every person and entity can play to sort of curb this hate, violence, and bigotry.
We're talking about recent hate crimes against Sikh Americans, both in Fresno and throughout the country, with Arjun Singh Sethi, the director of the Law and Policy for the Sikh Coalition, and also Deep Singh, one of the founders of the Chikara Movement, a Sikh youth organization here in the Valley. Tell us a little more about your community and your community's presence here in Central California. How many Sikh Americans are in Central California? And just give us an idea of the strength of your community here for people who might not be all that familiar.
Sure. And I think the picture here in Fresno is in some ways very different than the national picture. You have a Sikh presence and community here in Fresno stretching at least back for 100, 150 years. You have had even recent sort of KVPR stories have sort of highlighted their experiences here, sometimes in some of the stories about housing segregation. That was done specifically where clauses were there, even specifically against Sikhs from the 1940s in the Figarden area, for instance. In terms of the population size, it's hard to come up with a hard number. The estimates are somewhere between 30 to 50,000 in the county. And within that, the highest densities and concentrations tend to be in West Fresno, where, for instance, both the attacks occurred, but also significant communities in Selma, Kerman, Crothers, and some of the surrounding small farming cities around Fresno.
Police are still looking for the attackers in this event from 2015. Do you know if the 2013 event was anyone ever charged in that?
Somebody was indeed charged, Mr. Gilbert Garcia, and he was in fact convicted.
We're talking about this violence today. We also have things that maybe aren't physical violence, but certainly discrimination. Just late last year, some Sikh men from Fresno were at a San Diego Chargers football game. Tell us about what happened there.
Good friends of mine, in fact. So they were from Fresno. They went down to the Chargers game, although they would say they went down for the Broncos game and not to the Chargers game. But they were not allowed admission because some of them had turbans and they were told that they couldn't enter. Then they were able to kind of harangue the sort of security officials and speak to their higher-ups until they were finally allowed admission. But in the meantime, fellow tailgaters had said, because these men had turbans, we think there's maybe suspicious activity. And so their cars were checked and kind of specifically targeted to be checked. And some other, I assume, Broncos fans were also unhappy with what they saw and saw this kind of events play out and recorded on social media. And sort of it kind of took off and specifically around sporting blogs and having that discussion there as well about profiling and what are the circumstances and consequences of such actions.
Arjun was talking about how he'd like to see Americans of all faiths take action when they see this sort of discrimination. How common is that sort of discrimination, setting aside the physical violence and attacks that we're talking about here, but this softer sort of racism, softer sort of bigotry? How common is that that your community experiences, and much of it, unfortunately, is centered around the turban?
I think that is much more the sort of lived experience. I think that very much still happens here in Fresno, and to be honest, in some areas more than others, even within the geography, within the city itself. And I think those tend to be the quotidian or day-to-day experiences of most Sikhs, where whether that be an extra look or whether that be something that can go a lot more violent sometimes than that.
Arjun, what are your thoughts on that? How common is that? How common an experience is that in your community?
It's very common. Take our school system. We know from community reports and through our own statistics that turban Sikh youth are bullied at twice the national average. And we know, again, from community reports that Sikh Americans experience disproportionate harassment and discrimination in the workplace as well.
So before we talk more about this issue, let's talk a little about the Sikh faith and your community's cultural traditions and religious traditions. Tell us more about that. Go ahead, Deep.
Sure. The kind of historical view is that the tradition began in the Punjab area, which is in sort of the northwestern border area between Pakistan and India. Some 500 years ago, with the first sort of kind of prophet being that of who we refer to as Guru Nanak or Baba Nanak, living in the late 15th century, and continuing a lineage of sort of 10 gurus that followed, kind of preaching a new message that was based on sort of principles of remembrance of God, sharing with others, and hard and honest work.
And the significance of the turban.
So the significance of the turban really becomes crystallized during the 17th century, and it is sort of during this time where the 10th guru, the final guru, kind of begins to give an identity to the Sikhs as a separate order, a separate religious order, and then specifically amongst men, there's kind of an idea as part of that identity is to keep uncut hair specifically, and that which is usually wrapped around even culturally in the area by a turban, and some women choose to wear one as well.
And turning back to Arjun Singh Sethi, who's on the phone with us now, you mentioned your hope that the federal government will take these cases of alleged hate crimes seriously. What is the status there? Are we seeing prosecutions in these cases both in California and beyond? And what more can be done to foster that sort of collaboration?
So in the case of Mr. Amrik Singh Bal, we are working with the local police department, the Sikh Coalition is, to ensure that the incident is prosecuted as a hate crime. We are also in touch with the family. We have received support from the federal government. Last year, there was an incident where a Sikh gentleman, Inderjeet Singh Mukher, was attacked just outside of Chicago. Initially, the local prosecutor's office had decided that they were not going to file hate crime charges, but after community support, after some pushing and lobbying by the Sikh Coalition, the local prosecutor's office did file a hate crime charge. So we have found that recently and over the last year or so that both the federal government and localities are being responsive to our requests and to the necessity of prosecuting crimes where hate is the primary motive as a hate crime.
And Deep, I'll give you the last word on this.
I just wanted to say in some ways that does kind of show the significance of why locality matters. In Fresno, as opposed to possibly, for instance, Chicago or the outskirts of Chicago, public officials really did sort of jump on this right away. We had a town hall meeting. Chief Dyer came. Councilwoman Saria came. County Supervisor Pereira came. So because you have such a large Sikh community, especially here on the west side, and those that have had political aspirations and have even achieved a political office, whether that be Bill Nijjar, who's a councilman in Kerman, or Ruby Dhaliwal, who was the former mayor in the city of San Joaquin, the city of Fresno has reacted. Where there is a sort of angst is within the community is sort of bifold. One is, what can we begin to do to begin moving the chains forward on this particular issue, whether that be larger engagements and really beginning to change the city's own institutions? And there's also the double-ended question where within the community, there is some frustration, as I said, of these events, but there's also frustration within and say asking and challenging the community within. How should we be engaging not only with one another around these issues, but around the larger community that we live in?
Deep Singh is one of the founders of the Chikara Movement, a Sikh youth organization working on issues of social, health, and educational justice. He volunteers with the Fresno-based branch of Chikara. Also joining us on the phone today, Arjun Singh Sethi, the Director of Law and Policy for the Sikh Coalition. He is responsible for advocating and promoting policy solutions to civil rights issues that impact Sikhs and the broader American public, talking about this unfortunate instance of another hate crime against a Sikh American here in Fresno. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today. Stay with us. We'll be back with more of Valley Edition talking about Yosemite and photography coming up next. You're listening to Valley Edition. Imagine for a moment hiking the majestic John Muir Trail in the Sierra Nevada from Yosemite to Mount Whitney. Now imagine doing it in the middle of the night with a load of sophisticated cameras, tripods, and telescopes. That's just what our next guests, Scott Lang and Nick Foster, did last summer, all while the rough fire burned away in nearby Kings Canyon. Despite the smoke, the two went through with their 200-plus mile hike, all in an effort to complete their new crowd-funded book, The Range of Light, Night and Day on the John Muir Trail. Together, they call their project DartSkyPhotography.com, and they join us now on Valley Edition. I want to start with you, Scott. John Muir called the Sierra Nevada the Range of Light. That's actually what also lends its name to your book. When we talk about the Range of Light, what does that mean to you?
It's just the way that the light hits the mountains and the valleys and the peaks in the Sierra. It oftentimes just is magnificent at different times of the day, how it comes through the trees and creeps around the bend. It really just lends a beautiful touch to the mountains.
And your photography also documents a different sort of light. Dark sky photography is something that we don't often think about, but it's really impressive. Before we talk about the book itself, when we talk about dark sky photography, exactly what are we talking about? Give us the amateur's explanation of how you do this.
Basically, you're talking about taking long exposures at night. And what we've been doing most recently, the last few years, is doing that over landscapes. So we started off taking photography through a telescope, where we're actually taking pictures of galaxies and nebulae and such. But now we've kind of scaled it back to something a little more simpler, but still awesome. And that is just opening up the shutter for a long exposure in front of some mountains or a lake or anything, a desert. Just amazing foregrounds. It's just amazing that, you know, you can look into a dark part of the sky and see nothing, and then you open your shutter for a minute or two, and there's a lot going on.
When we talk about long exposures, how long in some cases are these?
Typically, the long exposures that we do are just a few minutes long, say 2 to 4 minutes right in there. If we want to get star trails, you can go even longer, as long as 20 minutes or half an hour. But for the most part, we'd like to keep the star trails out of the picture, and we like to keep the stars as nice little points. And for those, we do 2 to 4 minutes. And in that, we also have to track the sky to keep those stars as points. So the camera sits on a tracker and actually moves with the sky for those shots.
So you have this new book coming out that is a part of this project you've been working on for a while now at DarkSkyPhotography.com. This is the result of a hike on the John Muir Trail that began around Labor Day. This is also the time that the rough fire was burning. Tell us about your journey on the trail earlier in 2015.
Well, we had set out for the Sierras from our home base in San Francisco, and you know, we had no idea that the rough fire was going on. We weren't really paying attention to, you know, the wildfire scene. And when we came over into the eastern Sierras, we saw the smoke, and we were pretty heartbroken because, you know, this was a big production and a lot of planning. We kind of thought about what we're going to do, and decided that there's no turning back. You know, there was such a great commitment to the project that we would take the gamble and we head into the mountains. And, you know, we just got really lucky. About a week in, it rained, I think that was about September 14th or 15th, and the rain just, you know, took all the smoke out of the air, and that was kind of our close call with the rough fire.
So when you start on the trail, where did you start, and tell us about the journey itself?
Yeah, we started in Tuolumne instead of starting in Yosemite Valley because it's easier to get the permit, which those of you who have hiked the trail know that it's very hard to get the permit in Yosemite. And we had already hiked Yosemite numerous times anyway. So we started in Tuolumne Meadows, and it was very clear up there towards the northern half of the trail anyway. So while the rough fire was burning south of us, it really wasn't affecting us yet. And then, of course, as Nick said, by the time we got to that segment, the rain came for about a day and a half, and it cleared out the sky for us.
Is it especially challenging trying to do this sort of photography in a remote location like in the, you know, the middle of nowhere in the Sierra? What are the challenges of doing this sort of work out there?
Well, there are definitely some technical challenges, the greatest being the weight of the equipment. You know, a lot of people that head out on the John Muir Trail, they'll try to do it in a couple of weeks, and they'll have a pack that weighs, you know, about 30 pounds. And then here Scott and I come, and we've got, you know, 12 pounds of equipment, which we consider to be pretty light as far as what's required to take this type of photography. And yeah, we spent a lot of time planning resupplies, lightening the equipment, how to distribute it in our packs, keep it safe, and keep it dry. Those are probably the greatest challenges we had to overcome as far as doing astrophotography on the John Muir Trail.
Did you go into this project with an idea of, I want this shot, I know that there's this location on the trail, I know that these stars are going to be in this position? Did you plan it that much in advance, or is it just, we're going to camp here tonight, this looks like a good place to get some photos?
I'd say it was a blend of planning some shots and just knowing that there was going to be a lot of spontaneity. I know, for example, that we really wanted to get a picture of Cathedral Peak from a certain angle. So we can plan to arrive at our campsite at, say, 8 p.m., and then we'll hike up the side of a hill, set up our tripod, and we'll wait for the sun to go down. There was a lot of times like that. Muir Hut was another big example. We knew we had to get Muir Hut. It's such an iconic scene. But there were probably the majority of photos were, you know, we just saw something that was kind of nice, and we just figured we had to take a picture of it while we're here.
That night that we got the Muir Hut, we wanted it so bad, we actually ended up hiking about 23 miles that day, and we arrived at the Muir Hut finally at, I believe it was like 1 in the morning. So that was a very long day, but definitely one of our best shots from the trip was that one. So I'm happy we got it.
When you do this sort of astrophotography, long exposures, you get amazing images, but I also hear concerns in a lot of places, even in the mountains, even in the national parks, of light pollution. The fact that the dark sky that our ancestors may have enjoyed, that John Muir might have enjoyed, simply isn't there. Did you experience any of that as a problem? Is that a challenge that you have to overcome in some way in your work? Or are there still areas where you can truly experience the dark sky out there free of the glow of humanity?
I think we've seen some of the darkest skies that we've ever seen have actually been in the Sierras. As far as light pollution, I think we did experience some up near Yosemite. You know, there's a lot of cars in Yosemite Valley, so it's not surprising that there's a little bit of a glow coming out of the valley. Not to mention Fresno nearby creates what we call a light dome. But for the rest of the trail, I think that we found there was very little, and at times maybe a subtle light dome off in the distance, but we weren't even sure what the source of that was. However, if you want to talk about light pollution, our biggest concern on the trip was the moon. When the moon's in the sky, it completely blots out the fainter stars, and it illuminates the landscape to such a degree that it's actually kind of a nuisance. So on the John Muir Trail, I think the moon was our biggest enemy.
Did you try to plan your trip around that?
Yeah, but
it's there.
It's hard because we were on the trail for a little more than 3 weeks, so we actually had to go right through through a full moon, and you know, there's ways to deal with it. There were some nights when we went to bed early and woke up at 3 a.m. right after the moon had gone down. And there were other nights when we took pictures till 11 p.m. or midnight, and then we went to bed because the moon was starting to come up. So, yeah, it's all about planning.
How did you get started on a project like this? Where does this come from? You mentioned one of you talked about how you started taking pictures of galaxies and the heavens, but now you're focusing more on including the landscape in your photography. Where does a project like this come from?
I think we just recently, in the last couple of years, we've gotten into backpacking a lot, and especially in the Sierra. We love the Sierra. And so we wanted to combine the two together. And it's also very rewarding to be able to take some of these shots in areas where maybe nobody has done it before. There's not a lot of people willing to hike extra gear over those peaks.
And Nick, what do you think about how you got on this journey, literally and figuratively?
It's kind of part of, you know, pushing yourself, challenging yourself to do something, you know, maybe a little bit different. That's been kind of exciting for us. You know, we're walking along this trail and thinking, you know, what would it have been like to be a pioneer, someone who had walked across these mountains for the first time? And, you know, we'll never really know that feeling, but Scott and I are standing there in the middle of the night, and, you know, maybe it's 2 a.m. and it's 25 degrees out, and we're, you know, shivering around a camera sitting on a tripod. And sometimes I think we're crazy, but we might be the first ones doing it. You know, we might have been doing something new in that aspect. And one of the cool things about the book was that we can share that experience with other people. You know, a lot of people wouldn't be up for that sort of thing, but it's kind of a beautiful thing to look at, and being able to put it in a book and having the support through, you know, crowdfunding avenues and other people that are interested, it's really been a great experience for us so far.
That voice you hear is Nick Foster. He and partner Scott Lang are part of a group called DarkSkyPhotography.com. They have a new project, a book, that is the result of a hike earlier this summer on the John Muir Trail. This happened to be right when the Rough Fire was burning in the Sierra Nevada. And as they hiked the 220 miles through the High Sierra, they documented some amazing long exposure photography. Were you surprised, Nick, at the community reaction, for lack of a better word, in terms of your Kickstarter project and people who are excited about this project even before it actually resulted in the book?
Well, I am, and in some ways I'm not. We've had a lot of friends and family really show a lot of support and interest in this type of photography. But when you take it to a crowdfunding level and you're kind of throwing it out in the public, you have to wonder, you know, how many people are interested in astrophotography and how many people are interested in backpacking? And then you're looking at this kind of intersection of those two groups. So we didn't know what to expect, but it was met with a lot of interest, and that was, you know, a lot of support for us out there on the trail, knowing that whatever we're doing, all this effort, you know, people are going to be inspired by it, hopefully.
Scott, you also have a postcard project in addition to the book. Tell me about that.
So recently we've had some suggestions to put more of our images into postcard form. We thought about it and we came up with an idea that maybe we'd start a little Dark Sky postcard club in which we'd send recipients a postcard each month with one of our Dark Sky images on the front, along with current nighttime sky events on the back. So we launched a Kickstarter project last month, a rather short one. It lasted about 3 weeks, but it had an overwhelming response, and we'll be launching that actually this week. We're going to be sending out the first postcards. So as of this month, the Dark Sky Postcard Club is born, and we're excited about that.
So if people missed out on the Kickstarter projects, but they're still interested in your book or the postcards or anything else that you do, how can people see your work?
It's real simple. You can just visit darkskypostcards.com to get more information on that. And, of course, our main website, darkskyphotography.com, will have a link to where you can still purchase the book, and, of course, you can still get in on the postcard club as well.
Scott Lang and Nick Foster are together, the team, darkskyphotography.com. They have a new book documenting their 220-mile journey on the John Muir Trail earlier this year, Astrophotography of the High Sierra. It's called The Range of Light, and it is now available online, as well as their postcard project as well. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Hey, thank you.